This is the greatest threat to life in Los Angeles that we have ever faced. And the current levels of infection won't just mean COVID deaths. It means overwhelmed hospitals so that people who have other life-threatening health conditions might not get in or will be competing for those very same beds that COVID-19 patients need. People with strokes and heart attacks and other emergencies unable to get care.
Mayor Eric Garcetti on Friday warning about the growing surge of COVID cases that are starting to overwhelm LA area hospitals. The disease is spreading at levels we have never seen. More than 10,000 new COVID cases in LA County alone yesterday. Double the number of new cases reported just a week ago. All of Southern California is now under a state-issued stay-at-home order because ICU capacity in the region has dropped to below 15%. And while the death rate has not reached its peak during the summer, the more hospital capacity shrinks, the more likely the death rate is to increase. Joining us to talk about this is Dr. Brad Spellberg, Chief Medical Officer at the LA County USC Medical Center. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, what do you make of these numbers? Just seeing the doubling in a week, pretty shocking, right?
It's pretty terrifying for us in the hospital to contemplate how we are going to stay afloat with numbers continuing to rise like this. It is really important for people to understand that the number of patients that are coming to the emergency room with COVID now is substantially higher than it was in July when we were at our peak.
What does it look like inside your hospital? How are the nurses and doctors coping?
We're pretty exhausted, I'm not going to lie. It's been a long road. It's very frustrating for us to come in every day. You know, we have people with families who are putting themselves at risk going into these rooms, taking care of these patients. And then you drive home or you drive to work and you see people not taking it seriously, or you turn on the news and see people not taking it seriously. It's very frustrating.
Do you think that these orders will, these stay-at-home orders will make a dent?
Well, we hope so. I think there are a limited number of tools that we have. Yeah, until a vaccine becomes widely rolled out, mitigation strategies like what we're talking about, it's physical distancing, washing your hands, avoiding crowds, do not get into groups, and wearing the mask, those are the tools we have. And if people don't take those seriously, you know, we're not going to make it to the point where we have widespread vaccine availability before the healthcare system sort of crashes inwards.
So the hospitalization rate right now, from what I can ascertain, the number of people in the hospital for COVID is around 2,800. And Barbara Ferrer, the director of the public health department, said she wouldn't be surprised if daily hospitalizations went up to 4,000. What would that look like?
Well, you alluded to something really important in your introduction. It turns out that the state is correct. The health system will succeed or crash based on ICU bed availability, not total bed availability. We have more space in regular ward beds. We are running out of space in the ICU. And so if we fill up our ward beds, if the load was distributed evenly across the beds, and ICU remained within capacity, we would be okay. It is when the ICU becomes completely overwhelmed, that's when the wheels start falling off the wagon.
And in New York, during the height last spring, some hospitals turned operating rooms into ICU wards. Is that something you're contemplating?
So this is something I hear a lot, and it's a very important point. Our problem is not space. Our problem is not physical space. Using existing physical space just at LACUSC, we could create 80 to 100 new ICU beds. Who's going to care for patients in those beds? What trained doctors and nurses are going to care for the patients in those beds? If you look at the New York experience, you started having crazy ratios of nurses and doctors to patients, unsafe, crazy ratios. And you started having to use physicians who had no real training or expertise at complicated ventilator ICU management being responsible for that care. So the rate limiting resource is not actually space or beds or ventilators, it's people, trained experts.
The current positivity rate is around 11%. And I guess that's the amount of people who tested positive who were tested. Given that number, and given the fact that many people perhaps who might be infected haven't been tested yet, what do you think the current ratio is in LA County of people who have COVID? Like if you went into a public place, could you assume that maybe one out of every five people could be infected?
Well, this starts to become very complicated. So when you say infected, are we talking about people who have had COVID? Or are we talking about people who at the moment are actively shedding virus? Those are two very different answers. The latter turns out to be a very difficult question to answer.
What would you assume, though, as a doctor and as someone who is experienced in this matter, what would you assume the risk is in terms of going out into a public place when you look around you see how many people are out there?
I'm a simple country boy from Rancho Palos Verdes. I like to keep things simple, okay? Don't go out there. Don't go into crowds. We are using universal precautions. You should assume everyone you come in contact with is potentially contagious. This is a global pandemic. It is a once in a century event. We are asking people to modify their lives for a year. Not forever. We think we will be through this soon, but we have to, there's light at the end of the tunnel, but we have to make it to that light. If we don't honor the mitigation strategies, if we don't respect physical distancing and avoiding crowds and not gathering, and wearing the masks and washing the hands, the tunnel's going to collapse in on us before we get to the light.
And given the fact that we haven't really seen the effects of Thanksgiving yet, and we're already at this rate, and the fact that Christmas is 3 weeks away, what are you expecting, let's say, in the early days of January?
Well, that's the terrifying thought. I actually think we are seeing the effects of Thanksgiving right now. We are, in the window at which patients would be presenting. I would expect over the next 1 to 2 weeks, things will continue to get worse. But I do think this is the upsurge probably related to some extent to Thanksgiving. And if people are as lackadaisical about the December holidays as they were about the November one, I'm expecting a very, very rough January.
Dr. Brad Spellberg, Chief Medical Officer at the LA County USC Medical Center. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, is here to talk about the future of DACA, among other things. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Trump administration must fully reinstate DACA and admit all new applicants. That's the order from a federal judge in New York who, just a few weeks ago, also undercut Acting Secretary of Homeland Security Chad Wolf's authority to try to end DACA. We're going to talk about this now with Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Well, what was the judge's argument?
Well, the judge's decision here is that the acting director of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, did not have authority when he said, let's try and cut the legs out of DACA. Let's try and not allow any new applicants. Let's try and limit these permits from 2 years to 1 year. And if he doesn't have the authority to create those limitations, then they have to go back into effect. So this is probably the last chapter for the Trump administration versus DACA and DACA versus the Trump administration. And at this point, there's probably about 300,000 people who are new applicants eligible to apply for DACA protection. And there's a lot of people, of course, who now will go from having just a year of protection to the full 2 years.
And this comes in part, at least, from the Supreme Court's ruling in July, right? Basically, that the administration didn't explain how they wanted to end DACA in a proper legal way.
Right. That's exactly right. So all the way back in the summer when you and I talked about this, and the Trump administration was essentially trying to wind down DACA, which is, of course, a program created by executive order in 2012 by President Obama. And the argument was, well, if this was created by a president, it can be ended by a president. And the answer is, yes, it can. But the Trump administration, the Supreme Court said in Not These Words, was essentially so sloppy about it that they had to come forward with different reasons for why they would try and end a program that so many people relied on. There were a lot of reliance interests at play. And so because the program still stood, that's when acting Secretary Chad Wolf tried to not end the program, but whittle it down, kind of a death by a thousand paper cuts approach to DACA. And that's what the judge just said, no, you don't get to do that. So DACA is back to full steam as of today.
So as of today, new applicants have to be accepted into the program if they meet the qualifications.
Exactly. If they are eligible, then the order here is you have to let everybody know, Department of Homeland Security, don't do it quietly. You really need to let people know that this is still a program, that new people can still apply if they're eligible, and that the people who are already part of it will get their full 2 year protections that they then have to reapply for at the end of that 2 year cycle.
Could this be revisited by the Supreme Court sometime soon?
So the question that would be revisited by the Supreme Court would really be whether acting secretaries have authority to do X, Y, and Z. I expect that this is where law and politics meet and that it won't be revisited by the Supreme Court, in part because there are other bigger challenges facing DACA, and in part because I think a Biden administration will have to try and tackle this legislatively. And then all of these questions about DACA essentially become moot because there's overriding legislation, which is legally on stronger footing than an executive order.
Right. What is happening in Texas? I understand there's another case boiling there. Boiling yeah. might be too strong a word. Pending is maybe a better word. But that could be kind of a broader cut to DACA.
I think boiling was actually the perfect word when it comes to that case. So there are Republican attorney generals who are suing, and this is a full frontal attack on DACA. This is saying that the program itself is not legal. We've seen versions of this before. And, you know, we don't know what a judge will say with respect to whether or not the creation and implementation of the program is legal. We have, again, seen similar cases where judges have upheld the program, but it just stresses my point that we need to create a legislative solution. And Dreamers are pretty politically popular. This could be a moment for bipartisan support, but it's one of the things that needs to be on the top 10 list.
Right. Okay. Well, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about Joe Biden tapping California Attorney General Javier Becerra to head the Department of Health and Human Services. First of all, he doesn't have a medical background per se, but he has been at the forefront of defending the Affordable Care Act against the Trump administration. So is that primarily his bona fide for this job?
I think it's partly that. So Javier Becerra, of course, a longtime member of Congress in Southern California, and then was appointed by Jerry Brown to fill the spot that the attorney general spot that was left open when Kamala Harris became senator. I think my chronology on this is correct. And so what happens here is that Becerra, I think, was picked in part because he has been the epicenter of the Trump resistance. And part of this pick is not just that he was a vigorous defender of the Affordable Care Act, not that he has been talking about healthcare for a long time, not just that he's been talking about criminal justice reform, and he will be presiding over the issue of family reunification from children who were separated at the border. But I think this is also about showing that we really are going to see a completely different administration with respect to the Biden administration. And there was a lot of pressure to pick someone who is Latino to be part of the Biden administration.
Right. But given the fact that he's filed, what, more than 100 legal challenges to the Trump administration, and as you say, not just the Affordable Care Act, but DACA, the travel ban, all sorts of other issues, why not Attorney General?
That, frankly, was exactly my response. When I saw that alert, I thought, huh, well, not only egg on my face again, but a full omelet, right? Because I had said to people, oh, I think he's going to be Attorney General. So I don't have a fantastic insider answer to you, except for obviously the Biden administration has somebody else who they're viewing for that top spot of Attorney General. And this still is a big job. And I think that what we've seen in the past is you don't always have somebody who has a medical background. Now, of course, this is different. All we have to do is see your last segment because we're in the middle of a pandemic, and health and human services in the middle of a pandemic obviously is a different role. But it's not totally outside the norm. He's not totally outside of the model of who's picked for HHS.
How does he compare to other state attorneys general when it comes to his proclivity for filing lawsuits against the White House?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because there's been so much more litigation in this administration. Uh-huh. So, you know, with respect to the Trump administration versus a state, it really is versus California. And so California has either filed suits against the Trump administration, defended suits, joined other states. That's in part because we've tried to position ourselves again as the epicenter of the Trump resistance, in part because we have a huge office. There are a lot of people who work for the AG in California. There's a lot of resources there, a lot of money there. And so how do we compare? We're kind of like Texas under the Obama administration in terms of how litigious we've been. And of course, I think that will change when we have a Democratic administration in D.C.
Jessica Levinson, our legal eagle here on Press Play, and also professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, with Becerra potentially leaving his job as the attorney general here in California, the governor, Gavin Newsom, has yet another important state position to fill. He already needs to appoint someone to replace Senator Kamala Harris, who will become vice president in January. And depending on who he picks for that seat, he could have a third appointment to make. Joining us to talk about this is Emily Hoven at CalMatters. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you. All right, so I guess he is getting it from everywhere, lobbying and all sorts of solicited and unsolicited advice. He must be under a lot of pressure, Gavin Newsom.
He is, you know, and it's been going on for a long time. Back when it was just Kamala Harris's seat that he had to fill, he said there was people calling him saying, hey, can I babysit your kids? Can I get you coffee? I mean, every single person on earth was putting, you know, their words in his ear, trying to get someone in that seat. And obviously now with Attorney General Becerra going to Biden's administration, that's another, you know, top seat that Newsom now gets to fill. And in some respects, I think that it will actually make his choice a bit easier because he was under a lot of pressure from numerous constituents to constituency groups to appoint different people to the Senate seat. There were groups that wanted him to appoint a Black woman or woman of color. There were Latino groups that were suggesting he appoint a Latino or Latina senator. Obviously, there were women groups in there. There was LGBT groups. And so now that he has 2 and potentially 3 seats to fill, I think he will actually be able to alleviate some of that pressure on him and maybe satisfy a lot of the different demands that he is fielding right now. So it's a wealth of opportunities, but also, you know, it's a little bit of a political minefield because he will be determining in some respects the face of California politics for decades to come.
Yeah. Well, speaking of all these musical chairs, Becerra had been on the shortlist for Harris's Senate seat. Obviously, that's no longer a consideration. But was there, you know, but he had filled her attorney general seat. So was that a consideration that it would look a little weird if he kept taking her old jobs?
Yeah, I mean, that would have been a pretty strange coincidence if, you know, Kamala Harris went to the Senate and then Becerra became California Attorney General. And then he now becomes, you know, he takes her empty Senate seat after she becomes vice president elect. And so I think from the beginning, Becerra was a little bit aware of those strange optics of that moment. And on Twitter, for example, he had posted some tweets of pictures with him and Biden. And I think that he was, you know, potentially angling or considering that seat more than the open Senate seat, where another top Latino statewide official, Alex Padilla, who's Secretary of State, is considered a front runner for that seat. And so I think that Becerra and Newsom and, you know, all the political people in California were aware of the strange optics of Becerra twice following Harris and being appointed to her, you know, empty seat. So I think that would have been a bit strange for people.
Well, tell us about Alex Padilla then. Is he considered, you said he was considered one of the top choices. Is he considered the shoe? And that's what I've read anyway, that because he's so close to Governor Newsom and he's also Latino and he's getting a lot of pressure to appoint a Latino first one to the Senate from California, that Alex Padilla looks like the guy to beat.
He does. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people are thinking he's a shoo-in at this point. Obviously, none of us are in Newsom's head, so we're not exactly sure what he's going to do. I will say, too, though, that Padilla has been a little bit under fire recently for a controversial contract that his office awarded to a Democratic associated firm to run a voter education campaign in California. And though that wasn't a decision that he made unilaterally, it was his office's decision. People have sort of been questioning that a little bit. But I don't know if it would be enough to sway Newsom, who, you know, is not only a political ally with Padilla, but also a close personal friend of Padilla. And I do think Newsom will be very receptive to the argument of California has never had a Latino or Latina senator, despite Latinos making up 40% of the state's population. And so I think that Newsom, who has a penchant for making historic decisions, historic appointments, would sort of be hard-pressed to overlook that, especially considering that Padilla is also a friend of his and has long supported Newsom's own political ambitions.
Well, I guess speaking of, what are Newsom's political ambitions these days? Because he can't appoint himself to Harris's seat. Well, I guess he could, but he's not going to.
Yeah, most likely not. You know, this year is crazy, so you never know what's going to happen. but yeah, it doesn't seem likely that he would do that. You know, Newsom's political ambitions are very interesting because in some respects, him and Kamala Harris have sort of been duking it out for the top California politician for a long time. And back in 2015, when Barbara Boxer left her Senate seat, there was sort of this impasse between Harris and Newsom, between who should run for governor and who should run for senator. And, you know, obviously they chose what they chose and they are where they are today. But definitely having Harris in the vice presidential elect position could, you know, throw a bit of a wrench in Newsom's ambitions to run for president, which I think many people do think that he does harbor those ambitions. And it could, you know, delay those ambitions. It could complicate them. Yeah, where he goes from here is uncertain. And obviously, in some people are always joking that Newsom, in some respects, got the short end of the stick when he chose the governor position rather than U.S. senator, because, you know, obviously guiding a state of 40 million people through a pandemic is not a task that anyone really wants to have. And he's been dealt and has also had a lot of political minefields thrown at him and sometimes hasn't helped himself when handling those. And so I think that some people think that Harris, you know, what has a more favorable position for her future political career than Newsom does, simply because he's been in the throes of this extremely complex landscape of the pandemic in California.
Well, certainly she would be on a short list for any future presidential race, being the vice president. So I guess in that sense, you're absolutely right.
Right. I think that's sort of like a natural step for her to take. Whereas I think for Newsom, that step is a bit more complicated. And as I say, I doubt he would, you know, throw his hat in the ring if Harris is also running for president. And so that could delay him, you know, numerous years if he does want to ultimately end up in the White House.
Oh, wow. Okay. Lots of backroom dealing, lots of musical chairs in California politics. Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Emily Hovind, she writes the What Matters newsletter at CalMatters. Coming up, home prices are going through the proverbial roof, and some real estate companies are hiring homeless people to act as security guards for empty houses on the market.
Every house sitter is given an inflatable mattress, a mini fridge, and a microwave, and a bunch of like plastic or tarp to protect the carpets or the floors. And that's about it.
That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. An estimated 66,000 people in Los Angeles are homeless. The numbers have been going up year after year as housing prices are also going up year after year. As these dual crises spiral out of control, some real estate companies have found a way to take advantage of both. They're using homeless people to sit in their vacant properties as a form of cheap security while they try to sell the houses. Writer Francesca Mari looked into this for a story in this week's issue of The New Yorker, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Hi there.
Well, the real estate companies themselves don't directly hire homeless people, right? It's this company, this sort of middleman company called Weekend Warriors, which is an interesting name. Tell us about this company.
Yeah, so Weekend Warriors, they're a business licensed in California. They claim to have zero employees, but we know that they've been operating for at least 8 years. And the head of the company refused to talk to me for this article and claimed to have no knowledge of her house sitters. But she's contracted by Wedgewood, which is a huge developer and flipping company based in Redondo Beach.
Huh. So it's interesting, the Weekend Warriors group is basically not trying to take credit for this, although this is, from what you can tell, their operation. This is their business.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, part of that might be that they're clearly not paying taxes. They're not giving a minimum wage. They're not complying with labor laws. There are several judgments against the company Weekend Warriors for back pay. And I talked to a few of those house sitters who were dismissed or fired quickly and then never paid for the sitting that they had done.
Do you have any idea how many people they hire?
That's really unclear. I know that I personally met with and talked to more than half a dozen, and court records show a number more. So the other interesting thing is that the founder of this company, or the woman who's in charge right now, never meets individually with her house sitters. She basically hires them upon receiving a photo of them and a picture of their ID. And then the main house sitter in my story for The New Yorker, Augustus Evans, has been working for the company for more than 7 years, and he's never once met her. But it's really unclear.
So tell us about Augustus. And you say that he's been doing this for years now. How did he get into it? And what are his duties? What is his job, if you will?
Augustus, like so many Black people experiencing homelessness, found himself homeless after a divorce. And he had a criminal record. He committed one of the biggest bank robberies in LA history at the time, wow. in the early 80s.
Which one?
It was a bank robbery of the Crenshaw Savings and Loans.
Mm-hmm.
It was in 1983, and they came away with more than $200,000 in cash and several dye packs that exploded on them. Augustus served 7 years in the penitentiary, and when he came out with a criminal record, it was very hard for him to find work. He opened a poetry venue. He did various things, but you know, after he got divorced, he left his household and his children, and was planning to go sleep on a bench in Union Station when he ran into a couple of friends of his from the Black conscious community, and they owned an Afro-Caribbean shop and offered to let him sleep in the back if he helped at the counter. And he was doing that for 2 years when one of the customers, a retired undocumented man, said that he was a house sitter, and that's how he supplemented his Social Security income, which wasn't enough in a city like Los Angeles to pay for his cost of living. And so Augustus got the phone number of the boss of Weekend Warriors from this client, called her, and within several hours, a van came to pick Augustus up and deliver him to his first house-sitting property in Riverside.
And when you interviewed him, where was he? Where was he house sitting?
So I first met him when he was in Northwest Pasadena on Robinson Road. And throughout the course of the time we spent together, over a year and a half, he moved to Panorama City and then to Santa Ana.
All into vacant houses.
Correct, yeah.
And what was he supposed to do there?
So mainly they're deploying house sitters in gentrifying communities where there have been break-ins or squatters. And so he's always put in situations where people have been kind of breaking in, sleeping, eating in the properties and whatnot. And so he's supposed to tell them that he's security and that they have to leave.
Wow. And they get paid how much to do this, these house sitters?
So there are two gigs. There's like a night only gig, and that's $500 a month. And then the 24/7, which is what Augustus has always done, is $800 a month. And you're only allowed to leave the property to do your laundry or to go to the grocery store.
So $200 a week, that's not very much to live on. Well, I guess you have a free place to live, but that's just about it. Are there utilities? Is there heat in these homes?
That really varies. It depends on where the property is in the process of renovation. Augustus, most of the times I visited him, did have heat and running water. But another house sitter that I visited was in a property that had absolutely no heat. It was freezing, and only a toilet that worked. Not a sink or running water or shower or hot water.
Wow. And I guess they can't really have furniture in there because they're trying to sell the house, so they want it to look pristine, the company.
Yeah, either that or they're in the midst of renovating it, and so they just don't want furniture around. So every house sitter is given an inflatable mattress, a mini fridge, and a microwave, and a bunch of like plastic or tarp to protect the carpets or the floors. And that's about it.
How do these house sitters feel about this when they think about sort of the larger macro situation of these companies coming in and flipping these homes, often in the very neighborhoods they used to live and that are they're being priced out of? How do the house sitters feel about being kind of cog in this machine?
Totally. It's a question that I asked a number of them, and it was really heartbreaking to hear their answers. So Mansa Musa El, who is a Black Panther, when I asked him, does it feel weird to be guarding homes in gentrifying neighborhoods and guarding homes against people who are
in a similar situation as you. And he said, wow, let me think about that. And he looked up to the sky and then he snapped his head back down and he said, hell no, it just feels like white people controlling my existence all the time. And I asked another older house sitter what he thought about it. And he was incredibly smart about the way in which corporations and private equity firms were investing in Compton and other South LA areas that had historically received almost no investment, and how this investment was just washing away all of the people who had lived there and made that their home for so long. But he said to me, you know, the system is broken. If you want to get paid, you have to work for them.
Wow, that's heartbreaking. And I guess it's just going to get worse if a lot of people are, you know, thrown out of their houses because they can't pay their rent or their mortgage because of the pandemic.
Yeah, my biggest fear, I wrote an op-ed about this for the New York Times, is that if we don't have some sort of relief for people who have lost their jobs, who are behind on their rent or their mortgages, we're going to see mass displacement. And if we can't get some sort of relief passed, I mean, in the country, there are an estimated 30 to 40 million people who are at risk of losing their home once the eviction moratorium expires. If we see that, that's going to be a huge opportunity for investors and private equity firms. And they entered the pandemic with more money than ever before in their history. And so they are just waiting for an opportunity like the one that might transpire. And so it's really scary what we're on the precipice of.
Well, Francesca, thank you. And thank you for your reporting.
Thanks so much.
Francesca Mari, you can read her latest story in this week's New Yorker magazine. It's called Using the Homeless to Guard Empty Houses. Coming up, The Anatomy of a Hit. The new documentary series Song Exploder looks at how songs are made. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Back in the early 90s, this song was everywhere.
That's me in the corner.
R.E.M.'s Losing My Religion. What does it take to make a hit song like that? The new Netflix docuseries, Song Exploder, takes us behind the scenes to see how these songs are made. Other episodes feature musicians like Alicia Keys, Lin-Manuel Miranda. I spoke with the creator and host, Hrishikesh Hirway, earlier about the origins of this show. Initially, it was a podcast.
I started working on it in the spring of 2013, and it came out January 1st, 2014.
Tell me, give me a list of various, some of the highlights of the artists you've interviewed. I mean, a lot, right? I mean, Yo-Yo, from Yo-Yo Ma to Michael Stipe.
Yeah, it's coming up on 200 episodes.
Wow.
And there's been Fleetwood Mac has been on the show, The Roots, Nine Inch Nails, a lot of some of my favorite artists.
How did you come up with this idea? I know you're a musician and you've had a couple of bands. And is that what led you into doing this podcast?
It really came directly out of that. I've always tried to learn how to do what I was doing better. You know, I'm kind of self-taught in everything, like the instruments that I play and then certainly like trying to figure out how to turn songs into a record. All of that was stuff that I was just trying to learn on my own in my bedroom. So I would listen to interviews and I would read magazines and things like that. And most of all, talk to other musicians about what they were doing. You know, I'd hear a song by somebody who I was friends with, somebody I was on tour with or playing a show with. And I'd always want to ask them what their process was like and how they chose to do what they were doing in hopes that it might somehow teach me something about what I was trying to do. The podcast really came out of that. Like, how do you combine those kinds of conversations with the actual material of the songs which is the isolated tracks of a recording, so that people can hear not just the conversation about what goes into a song, but literally what the actual layers of sound are that you might normally not be able to pay attention to when you hear the song in its final form.
Is it hard to deconstruct a song or the creative process in that way? I wonder if a lot of artists don't know exactly how they make a song, that the creative spirit takes them somewhere and it's really hard for them to unpack it scientifically, if you will.
I think if you were to try and go at it head on, it might be, and not just with music, but any kind of creative act, right? Like if you're just trying to ask someone straight up why they did something, it might be hard to get to the root of it. The way that I tend to do these episodes and talk about music is the way that I experience it too, which is like, first you're just doing the thing. So, you know, like what's the first step in making a song? You know, like what was the first thing that you did? Okay, I sat down at a piano. Okay, well, why a piano? Well, maybe because I've played guitar all my life, but if I play piano, I think about music in a different way. And I was trying to think about it in a different way. Like right there, there's something that you learn about a person's practice and a little bit about their life just in that first decision. And they haven't consciously told you something profound, but I think it's insightful just getting that kind of procedural piece of information.
And it just gets bigger, right? You talk about bigger things like influences and emotions. And
I try not to talk about that stuff so directly as much as just let them lead the way. Really, I think if you can just kind of go step by step into what they did, you'll end up learning about what worked and what didn't work. And then you can kind of ask them, well, why didn't that work? Or where did that come from? I never really know what the answers are going to be, but the artists do. And sometimes it's just a matter of kind of shaking the snow globe of their memory to get that stuff to come up to the surface again.
Well, we have an example here. We have a clip from REM guitarist Peter Buck, and he's talking about learning to play the mandolin and how it fed into the creation of Losing My Religion.
And I just was fiddling with scales, and I just did this. And it wasn't until maybe a year later that I realized that little riff is really kind of close to something from Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. I went back and listened, and it's not the same, but I think it was probably an influence. So I've got a bluegrass riff taken from a Japanese musician doing an art score film with David Bowie in it.
So now you have to interview Ryushi Sakamoto, too, I guess.
Right.
So then it gets into, I mean, your interview gets into some really intense stuff, right? The relationship the band members have with each other. Is it the process of them talking about how they create a particular riff or a particular song that then kind of loosens them up to talk about these more delicate issues?
Yeah, I think talking about it in that kind of procedural way, the sort of like very matter-of-fact way of almost like you're going through the checklist of what it took to make the song, is a way to ease up some of the self-consciousness about the more personal feelings about it. I think also, whether they know it or not, it probably helps that they are talking to somebody who's made music or tried to make music in the past. So I can ask some questions that at least stem from my own, you know, obstacles and anxieties that I've had.
And how do you choose the songs that you want to talk about or the musicians you want to talk to?
I really would love to talk to everybody. But the people who I, you know, are on the TV show represent a pretty broad range of genres and backgrounds. And I wanted to get people who felt notable and interesting in their respective areas within music. Plus, also, I just wanted to talk to people who I think think thoughtfully about music, you know, that are going to have a story when it comes time to writing something. Because, you know, the fact is there are plenty of great songs and huge hits that don't necessarily have a great story behind them. And ultimately, the show is about music, but really the thing that fuels it is the story. So I'm looking for people who are going to be interesting to talk to.
Well, someone who is definitely interesting to talk to and has no shortage of stories is Lin-Manuel Miranda. He's in the series, in the Netflix series, and talking about the song Wait For It from Hamilton. And this is the song that's about Aaron Burr, Alexander Hamilton's nemesis and ultimate assassin, I guess you could use that word. here's a clip from that episode.
I was struggling for a long time with how to characterize Aaron Burr, who is the guy who will ultimately kill him. The breakthrough for unlocking Aaron Burr's character came when I learned that Aaron Burr's wife, Theodosia, is 14 years older, and when he first met her, she was married. She was married to a guy fighting on the other side of the war. And Aaron Burr basically waited for that dude to die or fall out of the picture. And I was just like, imagine Alexander Hamilton waiting for anything. I was like, and that's the difference. It's a complete difference in temperament. Then the challenge became, what song do you write that is the anti-my shot? How do you dramatize waiting?
Interesting. That is an interesting question. So how do you dramatize waiting?
Well, luckily, I wasn't the one who had to do it. He did it. I just had to ask him about it. but, you know, you can kind of see how that question gets answered piece by piece. It's about how the vocals are arranged and the space, where space is left and where it isn't left, and sort of like the rhythm. He talks in the episode about the difference in the way that the drums are handled between Aaron Burr's songs and Hamilton's songs. The drums have a very different kind of rhythmic identity, and that reflects the temperament of these two different characters too.
And so are you personally still making music as you're doing this podcast and TV show?
Yeah. Yeah. I've mostly been doing more composing work, you know, music for hire stuff. I've scored a couple of films and I scored a Netflix show, but I haven't done a lot of my own project, which is called the 1AM Radio, in a while, because this podcast was sort of supposed to be a side hustle to that, and it ended up taking over.
Is that frustrating to you, or exciting, or a mix of both?
Probably a mix of both, and depending on what's happening in the different parts of my life, it changes the balance of frustrating to exciting. When I first started it, I kind of was doing it in this cadence of one episode every 2 weeks, and I was making music and touring at the same time. After that, I was having so much fun with Song Exploder, I started making other podcasts.
So you have Song Exploder, The West Wing Weekly, which is about The West Wing, the TV show. Mm-hmm. You have a new podcast with Samin Nosrat about cooking in the pandemic, right?
That's right.
What else? Do you have any more? Seems like a lot.
There was a show that came out earlier this year. It was a limited run show called Partners. That was about partnerships between two people. Actually, it featured a couple of Press Play contributors. There's an episode with PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman about their partnership.
The Reply All guys.
The Reply All guys, yeah. And then there was the TV show for the last couple of years.
Seems like a lot. You have a lot on your plate. I don't know how you would fit in the music making.
Not well is the answer.
Well, so what is it about? I mean, obviously you're attracted to producing podcasts. So what is it about that particular medium that you find so appealing?
The first reason why I was drawn to it was because it was something that I could just do on my own. I already had a microphone. I already knew how to edit audio. I'd never interviewed anyone before, and I'd never done any kind of journalism, but I have a design background, and I thought I could use that to sort of help me construct how the stories should be told. And so it was something that felt within my reach. And it was like, I was able to put out the first episode entirely with what I had at home. So there's something really liberating about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that's different from making a TV show. So how did you change the way you work when you turn this into a TV show on Netflix?
Yeah, the translation of an entirely natively audio-based show into something visual was going to be really tricky, which is part of the reason why I wanted to work with Morgan Neville, the director who won an Oscar for 20 Feet from Stardom. On top of that, he's sort of like, in my mind, the foremost music documentarian there is. I relied a lot on his expertise in that to kind of help me figure out how we were going to approach that.
Yeah, he's great. Morgan Neville, very talented. Who do you have coming up on the show?
So on December 15th, there's going to be a second volume of episodes, and that batch of episodes includes Dua Lipa, Nine Inch Nails, The Killers, and Natalia Lafourcade.
She is incredible.
She's amazing. We went to Mexico to film that. We went to her hometown.
Oh. See, that's really also the advantage of having a TV show. You've got the money to do
it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And also a reason why, too. Because if it were just audio, there's no real reason for me to have to be there. But yeah, this was a chance to get to go see that and show the viewers, you know, what the context of that song was. Because that's a song that is informed by where she's from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was the song Hasta la Raíz.
A lot of her music is so deeply intertwined with that. It's so fascinating. Well, Rishi, it was great speaking with you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
That's Hrishikesh Hirway. He is the host and creator of Song Exploder, now streaming on Netflix. Well, speaking of podcasts, we have one ourselves that you can download and subscribe to, the Press Play podcast. You can get it at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. Well, that's it for the show. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.